Welcome to this week's episode of the Real Cyber Talk podcast. Today we're joined by James Ball. James, do you want to give us a little bit of a bit of background into yourself?
Yep, very brief bit of background. I do security bits and pieces. I run a now second generation family company that's been in security and tech for 35 years.
Awesome stuff. So the first place we're going to start is around security testing, but with a frame on compliance. What would you say, just throwing it out there generally, is the best way to look at security testing programs, building a security testing program for a business?
Ideally, in lockstep with any other testing program you're doing. You don't want to separate them too much. Yes, they're separate disciplines, but when you're doing your QA, when you're doing your user testing, you need to be doing security testing on that, and all of the results are defects that need to be resolved. So there's no point separating them. There's no point isolating them from each other. You need that cross-disciplinary approach.
Sure. Well, that makes total sense. And Tom, what, you know, you've been doing testing for a long time. I'm sure you've seen, you know, the processes that businesses take to start looking at testing in all sorts of different shapes and sizes. What's your initial take on that sort of, you know, carte blanche you brought into a business? They don't do any security testing whatsoever. Where do you look at? Where do you start?
I usually want to look at what they do. I mean, even if it's not the testing, you want to start looking at what the controls that they do have in place. They probably are doing some sort of code review or something before something's deployed into production, or an engineering team might have some security criteria or some at least build guides or something like that that they actually flow down into how they end up delivering on whatever their responsibilities to deliver are. And then kind of work backwards from there and saying, okay, you've got these things in place. I can see where the gaps might be. These are the areas I'd like to probe first.
Yeah, and then let's look at the reality though. You know, so often the reality is the decision starts with we want to get ISO 27001 or we want to get SOC 2. And particularly in ISO 27001, I mean, the wording is pretty vague, right? It's perform regular security assessments or whatever it says, you know, like something to that effect. And what people then very quickly do, I believe, is go to somebody and say, oh, that just means get an annual pen test done and get a monthly vulnerability scan done. And you know, more often than not, we see businesses with these certifications, and then we say, well, just security testing requirements, you know, we do monthly scans and we do an annual pen test. Why is that? Why do we end up with that from, you know, what seemingly does not say that in the document? I mean, PCI is a bit different, but
I think it was when it all started out, security testing was seen as a new thing. Pen testing was the big solution to everything. I mean, one thing that I do occasionally say is pen testing should be the last thing you do. And that's not to say you shouldn't do it. It's that if you are just doing pen testing, you are missing everything before that and completely wasting a very expensive activity. Mm-hmm. You want to start with your requirements, mm-hmm. and you can do security review and security testing on your requirements, mm-hmm. and take it all the way through from there. I mean, if you look at threat modeling, we've got use cases. You match those up with use cases. That is security testing and security review, mm-hmm. and that meets the requirements of ISO 27001. It meets just about every security standard out there if you're presenting it in the right way. Mm-hmm. But somehow we've got to this place where, oh, to be compliant, you just have to do pen testing at the end.
Yeah.
I think it's a lot like, to use an analogy, like your car or even your teeth, they're both probably good. So I'll just stick with the car one. The idea that just because you go for an MOT every year, that's the only check you need to do on your car. And that's also the check that's going to give you complete confidence and assurance that everything's absolutely fine. And if you're not checking that you've got oil before you go on a 200, 300 mile journey, or you're not checking your tread depth yourself, then you're probably going to find that that was a mistake, and you're probably going to be putting yourself in unnecessary risk at particular times that you're really could afford to save a hell of a lot of money on your MOT if you'd just, you know, check those things weekly, monthly, whenever it seemed relevant to do so.
Preventative maintenance. I mean, with an MOT, same thing with pen testing, there's always the option or the possibility you get a bad MOT. You get someone who just waves it through, doesn't care, doesn't do it professionally, you get the same thing with pen testing, and they're both single points of failure if you're not doing the rest of the review and maintenance around it.
So the answer is evidently then to look at your business rather than look at everybody else's business and look at the way that everybody else is doing it. So my immediate reaction to that is that that's not going to happen. People are still going to immediately go outside before they start to look inside, because that's quicker and easier and usually a lot less painful and gets you to the answers quicker. So what needs to change though? I mean, I know these frameworks are changing and change all the time, and quite often there's either, you know, potential scrutiny or changes down the pipe when it comes to being more verbose in how we recommend people approach security testing while still doing what frameworks are supposed to do and set the bar, which is then applied to a business and not necessarily being prescriptive. So is there more that frameworks can do to guide people towards looking at their business before running out and starting doing some testing versus how they currently read?
I don't think so. I think we've got a problem that you've got very prescriptive frameworks that tell people exactly what to do. PCI DSS, yep. Cyber Essentials.
Yep.
They say you must do these things. One size fits all. And they're meant to be a bare minimum.
Mm-hmm.
And they are a bare minimum. But they don't help you to integrate security. Then you've got the fuzzier frameworks.
Yep.
They say SOC 2, ISO 27001. Those aren't designed to tell you exactly what to do. They are designed to tell you how, well, SOC 2 isn't designed to tell you how to do anything,
yeah,
because it's not a certification, it's a report.
Yeah.
But ISO is a framework, it's scaffolding. You build your management system on top of it. The certification should be seen as optional. The problem is it's now seen as tick the box, get your ISO, instead of look at the standard, build up your own management system. Don't worry about the certification unless someone's demanding that you have it.
Mm-hmm.
The certification does not improve your security in any way.
Mm.
The process of going through and understanding how you manage security and comprehending your risk and how you do your testing is what will help you. Compliance isn't security.
Mm.
It's a way to try and measure it. And like any proxy measure, it has its limitations.
Mm-hmm. And Tom, I mean, you've been through ISO audit for the companies that we've been at and also external businesses. What's your take on security testing in the frame of compliance?
I think there is an element that people know what kind of ticks a box with an auditor that's going to come in and there is an expectation, I think, from people that if they've done X and Y, then they know they can sort of pass their audit with flying colours, and it's easy to therefore just kind of go down that path of saying, okay, I'm going to do this annual pen test. You know, everybody who comes in to do an audit says, show me your security testing, and then they show an annual pen test report, and then they say, okay, fine, let's move on to another area. But it's been my experience that when you give an auditor demonstration that you are doing not just what everybody else does, but something that is genuinely considered and something that genuinely focuses on things like continuous improvement, that all of a sudden the rest of the audit goes a hell of a lot easier, because you're not just doing the thing that everybody else is doing, you're doing something that's considered, something that's relevant to your business, and you're willing to actually take steps that are improving measures, not just tick box measures.
Yeah, 100%. So I guess the summary there is let's have more threat modeling, let's have, you know, take more understanding of how your business works, processes that you have in place, etc., before then rushing out to decide what security testing will need. I think, you know, given most of us three are more on the vendor side of things, you know, I think we're all praying for the day when more customers come to us and say, I need a test that looks like this because of this, and this is what I'm looking to get out of it, and these are the attack vectors, etc. I think when that day comes, then we'll be a lot more confident in the fact that the industry is maturing. Cool. So the next thing on the list to talk about is some of the complexities around vulnerability management. Now, this is a global conversation, right? You know, people try to solve this with people, process, and technology. You know, sometimes one, sometimes two, sometimes all three of them. And I guess what's sort of, I guess the first thing just to touch on this, just to sort of get out there, is that, you know, patching everything, fixing everything, just isn't an option anymore for a lot of people. You know, it's just, there's too much to do. The landscape's moving too quickly, and it's not just as simple as just running a patch for a lot of businesses.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the biggest problems you get with vulnerability management, and I see it time and time again, not always, but almost always, is it never considers the bandwidth for resolving things. It's, let's do the scan, okay, we've got our hundreds of thousands of vulnerabilities, throw that over the wall, give it to IT, they'll go and fix it. They need to patch everything. Even when there's some degree of prioritization, it usually doesn't take into account the actual business considerations. It doesn't say, these are the critical systems, the ones that matter, and where if we have a problem, it's going to be a real problem. And even when they do that, sometimes it's simply wrong. It's, yes, a critical system, but it's locked away so tightly, or it's so robust and ancient that it's secure by being obsolete. So you've got to consider what can be fixed and what you need to fix. And it can't just be throw the report over the wall. There's got to be a measure of intelligence applied to it first.
And it's not, I don't think, even just what can be fixed and what needs to be fixed, but also what you want to fix is probably an important thing. We look at vulnerabilities as if they're always things that somebody needs to address. But vulnerability management is just a sort of subset of risk management. And we're not going to go out there and tell every business you shouldn't be accepting certain risks, or, you know, some vulnerabilities or things that get raised as vulnerabilities, I should say. What isn't a vulnerability is a contentious topic of its own, and could probably spend, you know, hours just debating that. But some of the things that get reported as vulnerabilities exist because they are features, and them being features provide a material benefit to the business or its users or somebody else. And so, supposing that there is some need by the business to remove that feature from the organization, rather than to just simply consider the risk and to address it, I think isn't really pragmatic.
The classic one there is timeouts. Let's say you've got a 4-hour timeout in the system. It's only accessible from particular locations. It's used for certain things where someone's going to be glancing at it every half hour, every hour. Why on earth would you want to cut that down to a 2-minute timeout and mean that every time someone needs to look at it, they log back in? You're just introducing another vulnerability there, which is that they're not going to bother looking back in.
I think this is, you know, there's an awful lot of talk now about, you know, the CVSS. I mean, ultimately what we're talking about is exploitability. You know, how likely, how easy is it going to be to exploit something? But there's another couple of words. I mean, and these things, just because these things underline our platform, but they don't get talked about as much, and that's actionability and confidence. So you know, especially when we're living in a world dominated by automated tooling, where, you know, I don't know what percentage of vulnerabilities companies are dealing with that are found by automation, but I reckon it's probably in the high 90s, I suspect. You know, confidence needs to be a big thing. Is this thing really a vulnerability, and to what extent can we say that it is before it's then kind of tasked to an engineer? Because, you know, we talk about burnout and everything. I think a good way to burn someone out is having them spend 20 minutes on something that isn't actually a thing, right? They find out that it's not even a vulnerability. I imagine that can get quite frustrating. And then actionability. I think you've touched on this briefly before. Can we actually do anything about it? You know, is this in third, fifth party code? Is this in a system that's potentially locked away and we can't actually do anything about it? A good example of this is OT environments, right? You know, brilliant, you found a bunch of vulnerabilities. Now it's time to talk about how we make sure you can't get to that vulnerability because it ain't getting fixed.
Yeah.
NHS, you know, using old kit that runs a Windows XP. I don't know if that still happens, but it was definitely still happening. you know, this is not an IT conversation. You're asking them to buy a new MRI machine. Like, you know, it's not something a CISO typically has the budget for. Do you know what I mean? So actionability, confidence, and exploitability, like trying to understand all these different things that go into effectively prioritizing something and not just the risk rating.
Cool. And does a threat exist? So looking at the MRI machine one.
Yeah.
The number of people out there who actively want to exploit proprietary code running an MRI machine, yeah, running on Windows XP, the worst you might get is denial of service. That's bad.
Yeah.
But no one's going to go in and start shifting around polarity of magnets and mm-hmm. doing things. That's just not a realistic threat scenario.
Yeah.
Outside of, say, private hospitals dealing with mm-hmm. billionaires. So it is considering that threat as well, and that ties into the exploitability and actionability. What resources do they have, and what motivation do they have?
And then understanding those things when we're going back to our earlier point, and actually looking at the testing as well, because you know we talk about vulnerability management in the sense of, well, I've got this vulnerability now, I've got this piece of data, I have to do something with it, but that piece of data, that vulnerability on that MRI machine, if that was tested in the context of the threat model, then the chances are the vulnerability will be presented in relation to the threat model, instead of it being presented in a way that's going to mean that it gets prioritized in a different fashion. So by starting earlier in the chain and starting with that before the test, actually then helps the vulnerability management process, testing more intelligently, so to speak.
I think there's also a problem with, I'm going to get flack for this, security researchers here.
Okay.
So there's all of these lovely, exciting vulnerabilities which pop up with logos and brand names and mm-hmm. similar. Speculative execution would be a good example. Has that ever been exploited in the wild?
Mm-hmm.
Have any of the downgrade attacks against mm-hmm. TLS been exploited in the wild? They work in lab, they're very sexy, they're very exciting. Mm-hmm. Everyone then runs out and starts putting all of their effort, all of their resources into fixing those, and ignoring the fact that you've got a shared password.
Yeah.
You've got improper permissions set up.
Mm.
It's not about the exciting stuff, it's about the boring stuff that actually gets exploited.
Yeah, I think you're speaking to a part of the industry, I'm sure you've got an opinion on this, that, you know, the I don't hear it as much anymore, although it's definitely still there, is this, you know, this idea that good hackers find CVEs. And you know, you hear it in job interviews, you hear people saying, I've never got a CVE, but that's a goal of mine. You know, can you just explain a little bit about the flawed logic in sort of finding CVEs as just that, as being a potentially not a good thing in its own right?
Well, I don't know that it's necessarily not a good thing in its own right. It is important to go out there and find CVEs, and it is providing some value in being able to prevent these things. But the contribution that actually makes to the wider cybersecurity community is small in comparison to being able to explain to somebody's nan why it's important that they don't have the same password for absolutely everything. You know, mm-hmm. the it looks really, really exciting to your colleagues who think, oh, you know, this is proven a depth of understanding, but it's not materially changed the or moved the needle in terms of how secure we are as a company, as a country, as you know, a community, mm-hmm. in the same way as some of the maybe softer skills that people would benefit from being able to show.
Definitely. Cool. I guess moving on to our final talking point of the day, wanted to touch on something that I know we've debated this online a little bit, James, and I'm sure everyone's got an opinion on it. But the idea of a VC cell fractional CISO, I'll tell you what, let's just go with fractional CISO. Let's just call it what it is in relation to, you know, every other type of, you know, fractional time executive. You know, the whole concept of a virtual just screams commercialization and what sells better. So fractional CISOs, can they work? And you know, to what extent?
So I have strong opinions on this one. They can work, but not as what they're named.
Yeah.
And the reason I say that is because if you are a CISO,
yeah,
in theory, according to good corporate governance, you need to be the chief officer of the company in command of information security. That means you have to have ownership, you have to have autonomy over it, and it needs to be one of your core duties. Now, if you're an outside contractor, there's always going to be some conflict, particularly if you're working for multiple companies. Where it can work is providing that advisory support for someone inside the company, which, let's be honest, it's going to be the head of IT or better yet, the head of ops,
mm-hmm.
to take ownership themselves, mm-hmm. because they are accountable for it. They have autonomy and the authority to do something about it. You can then provide the expertise and the guidance and the support for them to provide that internally.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there is a fundamental conflict if you are trying to do it part-time.
So let's play devil's advocate here. Let's say, you know, helicoptered into a business, 2 days a week, you've got complete control of the security budget. You are the big dog in charge. You've got a full security team underneath you, but you're doing that job 2 days a week. Why can't you know, everything's square. The only difference between you and the actual CISO is you're not employed and you're only working 2 days a week. What are the big problems with that?
You're not employed.
Yeah.
That's the big one. 2 days a week is also a problem.
Yeah.
The person who owns security there is the head of your security team.
Correct.
It's not you because you're part-time. Mm-hmm. Nothing wrong with that. It's a great thing to do. It makes sense for a lot of businesses to have that sort of support advisory role there to empower their internal people. But you cannot own it from outside the business. If you're not there every day, if you're not there all the time, then you don't have ownership.
Yeah. And if we're talking about that particular role, then it becomes more about security advisory. Like, I know people that have businesses very similar to yours. You know, they're two or three people. They have a generalist approach to security in that they've kind of been around the block and they understand, they've got their focuses, but they do understand, you know, the broader spectrum. And they sell VCSO services. Right? And I guess you probably recognize this as something that you don't want to actively sell, but can you understand, you know, the fact that this, if it's purely just a marketing term at this point, and actually, you know, realistically, it's security advisory and maybe that doesn't sell as well?
Yeah, it's security advisory and that does not sell as well. I can say that from experience. It's much easier to sell as a VCSO than a security consultancy or security advisory at the same level, even though one's being more honest about what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Is it the same? Obviously, you get fractional CFOs, fractional any CTOs, anything like that. Is it the same across the board, or do you think this is a unique problem to CISOs and cyber and the risk ownership component?
I don't think it's unique because a CTO, a CFO, they own risk as well. But it's the same thing. They are providing that support to the board. They can be fired or dismissed for failing to do their job, but they can't really own it in the same way as someone who is in the business.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the part-time piece is less of an issue. It's that employment piece.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I get that. I get that. And I guess, you know, doing that at the same time for potentially two or three businesses, you know, you're going to get, it's going to be a bit of a tangled mess, isn't it, trying to do that, especially when we start talking about, you know, larger businesses and everything else. And I guess just to touch on this, I mean, I guess the problem with this, in my eyes anyway, isn't necessarily that the 1,000, 1,500 staff business has made, you know, a boo-boo in misspending on something. The problem with this happens, I think, down at the SME level, where, you know, I think we've all seen this a lot. Small business, maybe 35 staff, they have just realized that whilst they don't have to comply to any regulations, they are under the regulations of their customers, right? Their customers now tell them that if they want to supply to them, they need to be a secure business. And I know I haven't got enough fingers to count how many times I've been approached to say, we need to do security. You know, there's a lot of those businesses out there, and I think they're the ones that can often be absolutely fleeced on their first time out and potentially then don't come back again. And then, you know, that kind of thing. So, you know, we can moan about or we can joke about the commercialization of the industry and how it's wrong and shouldn't go out, but that's a problem, right?
I think that's a wider problem. That's the same problem as the CEO of a three-person business existing.
Yeah.
There's a general guideline that if you don't have 10 people in the business, you don't need a CEO because there is not enough responsibility. There's not enough headcount. Now, if you're considering a CEO as in a 10-person business, you certainly don't need a 10-person business with a CEO, a CTO, a CISO, a CRO, a CFO. Mm-hmm. Not everyone needs to be a chief.
Yeah.
There's something about too many chiefs spoil the broth. Or,
yeah.
But we need to get away from this idea that having a C in your job title is somehow important.
Mm-hmm.
When you're working as an SME,
yeah,
mostly you don't need it. And trying to pretend that you've got those responsibilities and that experience, mm-hmm, and that accountability,
yeah, yeah,
when you don't need to have it, mm-hmm, needs to be dealt with. Worse still is the idea of directors who aren't actually directors of the company, but that's very much an American thing.
Yeah, well, let's play devil's advocate on this one again. You're a information security manager. You've done your 5 years as your sort of practitioner roles, and you've stepped into a management gig. You see CISO on the horizon. This happens in every other sector. Right, you know, InfoSec manager, if we're taking conventional titles, head of InfoSec, CISO, something of that, you know, particularly if you're in a company with a security team that has its own org chart, right? I've done this myself in sales. You need the title at a smaller business to then get a bigger one. Yeah, you've been a head of InfoSec for 5 years. As soon as you've got the Chief Information Security Officer title, that makes it significantly easier to then go and get it somewhere else or get it at a company with 5,000 more staff or whatever. So how do we balance this off with who are the charlatans and actually who's just gone to their boss and said, look, I know I'm an InfoSec manager. We've now got six, seven people in the InfoSec team. I want to be the CISO because this is going to help me in my career progression, and that business that now has maybe 90 to 150 staff says, crack on, yeah, you're going to stay here for the same money. I'll give you the title. Is there anything wrong with that?
There's a lot wrong with it. I just don't think it's fixable.
Yeah.
I'm not ready to fix the whole corporate world and career progression and all of the bits around job titles. So I accept it's a problem. I'm allowed to not like it, and I don't. But I also accept that happens. You've got to be pragmatic.
But I think a lot of it stems from what we've talked about on the podcast and just you and me many, many, many times before, which is that a lot of, like, you don't become a CFO of a tiny little business and therefore become qualified to be a CFO of a massive enterprise organization going through IPO and things like that. You follow an established path, you are capable of particular things, and that qualifies you for that next job role. CISO is not like that. There are different CISOs who...
Well, I think in all those industries, though, you still have to take that fringe job. You still have to take that first CFO job, which is borderline, probably shouldn't have a CFO, but you're always going to get those businesses that are on that fringe of needing a CISO versus not.
Yeah, but I think where we failed as an industry is to really have a good way of giving the tools to the people who aren't necessarily cybersecurity literate of establishing whether or not somebody is competent for a particular role in the same way that you would in other more mature and more sort of other roles that have been around the block a little bit longer.
Well, we had this thing when we were talking to another guest a few weeks ago, and he was a CISO for a long time, and just this the very nature of not having the same sort of inbuilt training, executive training that comes with the path to being a CFO and the path to being a COO, for example. Quite often people are thrust from practitioner to not necessarily the boardroom, because, you know, being in the boardroom is very different to the executive suite, etc. But sort of, thrashed from practitioner to, you know, communicating with business folk in a business-like way, it's not the kind of thing you've got a crash course for. It's the kind of thing you need two or three years experience at before you're competent in, right?
Yeah, you want to, it's almost an apprenticeship.
Yeah.
I mean, there are different ways to do it. You can almost crash course it. And basically, if you get dropped in at the deep end and survive 6 months, you've probably got some clue what you're doing.
Yeah.
The problem is, if you don't survive 6 months, you may have just broken the business.
Yeah.
So there's got to be some level of due diligence, and job titles don't quite cut it.
Mm.
I'm not sure what the solution is. There's training courses and all sorts of other things. Where they're not a perfect solution.
Mm.
There is no perfect solution. Businesses should be doing effective due diligence to make sure you've got the appropriate skills, not just looking at job titles and leaving it there.
And just before we finish, I guess on the same train of thought, we talk a lot about, you know, the difference between a CISO and maybe a practitioner or an infrastructure manager in relation to skills. Is often that ability to be able to talk to a business and apply things in a business context and understand that side of things. How would you best summarize that? Because I appreciate talking to the business and using jargon like this probably isn't that helpful in relation to the actual skills that you need. But for somebody that probably communicates with you know, the CEOs of businesses or other teams regularly, what would you say those things actually are in layman's terms that you need to know?
Enough knowledge to interpret between the practitioner areas and the executive areas. And there's a misunderstanding about what executives are and do. Ultimately, executives are highly trained, refined decision engines who need to be able to make decisions on limited filtered data and limited experience quickly and decisively. That's completely different from the type of skill set of practitioner specialist has. It's even different from what an infosec manager would have. It's not that same speed of decision making. It's not on the same limited data. You're much more embedded in it. So we need to get away from this idea that you've got to, I don't want to say got to work your way up through the practitioner roles, because that helps, that gives you that base of knowledge. But there are other skills that come in, and you can't just take one path to get to that executive level, not if you want to be good at it.
Makes complete sense. Thank you so much, James. It's been a fantastic conversation. And thanks everyone for listening. Bye now.